Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.
18 minutes after 5 o'clock. Assalamu alaikum. Shukran so much for joining us. I'm with you until 6 o'clock tonight. And, you know, every Friday we bring in a mover and shaker, someone who's doing well in their field, who's really making waves. But unfortunately, today's guest is not face-to-face, but we have him on Skype this afternoon. He's young, he's fresh, he's vibey. He's really got a lot to say on literally everything happening in South Africa at the moment. And his name is Sizwe Mpofu Walsh. Sizwe, assalamu alaikum. So good to finally have you with us on air.
Wa alaikum salam. Pleasure to be with you.
So I just want to start off with your bio quickly. You graduated from UCT in 2012, where you were the president of the Student Representative Council in 2010. In 2015, he earned an MPhil in International Relations with distinction from the University of Oxford, where he's currently pursuing a PhD. Also one of the Mail and Guardian's top 200 young South Africans in 2013. And this year he won the City Press Tafelberg Award for his forthcoming book, Democracy and Delusion, due in 2017. And this book will be accompanied by a hip-hop album as well. Says with that biography alone, I mean, you're not even 30 yet. How on earth? Let's start up at the beginning. You know, you are probably one of the most dynamic young South Africans today. Very vibrant. You've got a really alternative voice in politics and social issues. I imagine you had a really interesting upbringing. What was that like?
Thanks. That's very kind. I did. I grew up in a very political household, and both of my parents were involved in the struggle, and I was born in 1989, which was obviously an important transitional period in South Africa. And so I grew up with politics and social issues being the order of the day at the dinner table. Mm-hmm. And attended a multiracial school during primary school, which I think was also quite formative, and a lot of struggle parents, as it were, sent their children there. And then I went to St. John's College, which was sort of a so-called elite private school in Johannesburg, which was the very opposite of my primary school. And so it's been a diverse upbringing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, my father's black, my mother's white. So it's, let's put it this way, family meetings are like a gathering of the United Nations General Assembly.
Yeah. Now, given your father's role as a prominent attorney and political activist, Ali Mpofu, was it kind of inevitable that you'd end up in politics, and what kind of influence did he have on you?
I think so. He's always been a tremendous inspiration. I think a lot of people don't know what kind of circumstances he came from. I mean, growing up in Duncan Village in the Eastern Cape, in a one-bedroom house with a family of five, and getting a scholarship, the only black student in the Eastern Cape at the time to get a scholarship to study at Wits, obviously served as a great inspiration for me, and obviously his acts in democratic South Africa, and especially recently. But it would be unfair to suggest that he's been the sole influence, because my mother, who I grew up with and really lived with for most of my life, is also a very important political thinker and person, and has had an equal, if not greater, influence on my thinking and the person that I am.
Mm-hmm. Let's move quickly to your days at UCT. You know, UCT is obviously a flashpoint of violence, well, not violence, rather protest at the moment because of Fees Must Fall and all of that. What were some of the student issues at the time when you were at the helm of the SRC?
Well, the student issues were very similar. Mm. The transformation of the academic enterprise, the student demographics, the iconographical debate hadn't sparked as intensely as it has now, but there were still people, a few SRCs before me, who had already called for the Rhodes Statue to fall. Mm. The admissions policy and whether race should be a proxy for admission to UCT. So I think these issues have been circulating the academic space for a very long time, but I think the beauty of what the student protesters have been able to do over the last 2 years or so is really take a very complex set of debates and dilute them down into very tangible demands, you know, one or two demands that actually relate to all these other debates. So whether you're talking about fees, we had a big debate over fees when I was on the SRC.
Yeah.
So I think the issues are the same, but the vehemence with which they're now being brought to the authorities' attention is changing, and I'm very glad about that.
Mm. Now, you also led the charge for the Roads Must Fall movement at Oxford University, where you're currently at. I know last year it was quite a big issue. You're also urging the university to confront institutionalized racism. Is the university engaging students on this? What has the debate been like since then? I mean, has this sort of been part of the university's discourse?
That's right. You know, a lot of people said to me when I was, you know, part of this movement at Oxford, you know, why are you doing this? Like, you're so lucky to be at Oxford. You should be grateful.
Yeah.
But the thing is that these institutions are really the center of where a lot of South Africa's problems began, you know, in terms of colonialism. Rhodes himself was actually a student at Oxford. And so if we don't fight the battle there, then we leave open the possibility that these things can happen again from there or continue to spread from there. The response was interesting. I think in South Africa, we're much more comfortable about addressing these difficult issues. I mean, South African life is almost exclusively about difficult issues, and we're so used to talking about them now that it feels normal. But Oxford had not had this debate properly for a very long time. And so when we took the debate about institutional racism to Oxford, they were quite surprised. And I think in many ways, and this is encouraging as a South African, the debate about race, difficult as it is far in advance of where it is in Europe and in the UK. And we actually have a lot to teach those societies, I think, about coming to terms with racial oppression.
Mm. Now, how are you looking at what's currently happening at our universities? Yesterday, again, we saw the excessive use of force at Wits universities, and it just seems like university management and students have reached a stalemate. How do you think we should be getting out of this quagmire?
Sure. I think the events of yesterday should give all of us great cause for concern. When you know, a member of the Muslim community, Shaira Kala, is shot 13 times in the back defenselessly. I think we all need to really just, you know, reconsider the way that this whole question is being framed, I think, in the mainstream media. My view is that although there have been mistakes made by the students, their cause is fundamentally correct, and society should be rallying behind them in order to pursue the cause of free education. You know, especially in our community, the Muslim community, I often hear, you know, khutbahs about the Palestinian situation, for example.
Mm.
But when you think about the fact that South Africa is the most unequal society in the world, people who have no problem supporting Palestine, even though maybe some small mistakes have been made on the side of the Palestinian cause, all of a sudden don't support the disadvantaged and the disenfranchised in South Africa, the most unequal country in the world. And I think sometimes we need to realize that in an unjust, unequal society, it's our duty to be on the side of the marginalized, even when the media is painting the marginalized as violent or irrational. So I'm fully supportive of the student movement and for the call for free education, which I believe is also feasible.
Mm. Now, you know, a lot of people are saying that the South African government, there's not really been a real leadership on this matter. Do you think there is a lack of political will to address this issue?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I think the universities bear a lot of responsibility and have made significant mistakes.
Mm.
But really, this comes down to the political will. The irony of the situation is that the students are protesting for a policy that the government claims to support.
Yeah.
And they are protesting on an issue that only the government can really solve. Now, when you look at the South African budget, providing free tuition, which is one component of free education, obviously you have other components like accommodation, would only cost 22 billion rands. Out of a budget of 1 trillion rands, that's really quite doable. So the students are not only pursuing an issue that I think is important, but they're also pursuing an issue that's achievable. The lack of political will on behalf of our government and the excessive brutality that they've resorted to, not for the first time, I think is deeply troubling and just another example of the fact that I think the government that we have at the moment is illegitimate.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to move on to something else. You were speaking a bit about your upbringing. Tell us about your journey to Islam.
Sure. So as I said, my family is like a gathering of the United Nations, and Islam, a strand of Islam has been in my family. I have some family that lives in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother converted to or reverted to Islam about a decade ago. So Islam had always been in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And I also married a Muslim woman who brought me into the fold of Islam, as it were. And mm-hmm. I always say to people, relationships are crucial to any religion. You may have parents who are Muslim, or you may have an uncle, or it may be a spouse, but the relationships you have in your life are determined by your beliefs and vice versa. And so those factors kind of came together to at least make me confront and read about Islam. And I think that was the difference, as I was raised Catholic. But when I actually started reading the translation of the Quran, the Hadith, the Sirah, I started realizing the important similarities between both religions, but also the ways in which the Hadith really spoke to parts of my belief system that really resonated and that I'd never seen before. And so it's been over 6 years now, and Islam is a fundamental and important part of my life.
MashaAllah. Do you find that, you know, through you learning about Islam and on your personal journey through Islam, did you find that Islam sort of answers all the socioeconomic challenges that we face in contemporary society today?
Well, I think Islam confronts us with a set of challenges that we have to adapt to. And I think we need to realize just how strong Islam is on justice and on equality. And in a society that's perhaps the most unjust and the most unequal in the world, Islam becomes a crucial tool, I think, for people to think through how we liberate ourselves from that condition. And obviously, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam's life, not only as a religious leader, but also as a political figure, also as someone who was intent on reducing inequality and injustice, I think is an example to us in the face of powerful opposition. You know, and today when we think about interests in the South African media, or the way that people might be ridiculed, or, you know, the way that people might be shot with rubber bullets or live ammunition, we face serious threats, but Islam is a calling, I think, to have the bravery and the courage to pursue justice no matter the obstacles.
So, Izwe, we just have to take a break for our news bulletin. Stay on the line with us. We're going to continue the conversation soon.
Drive Time 91.3. Always on the cutting edge.
Five 35, and welcome back to Drive Time, the second part of our conversation with our face-to-face, in inverted commas, our face-to-face guest, Sizwe Mpofu Walsh, just chatting a bit about, you know, who he is all about. Sizwe, thank you so much for staying with us. I want to turn to this year's elections. I know that you had quite a bit to say. You had very interesting viewpoints on the election campaigning and, of course, the outcome of this year's elections. I mean, how did you interrogate what we saw, which was obviously unprecedented in this year's local government elections?
Sure. I mean, I think the outcome of the local elections was really, really surprising, but really positive, in the sense that, as I said, I grew up in an ANC household, and I have pictures of myself wearing an ANC t-shirt with an afro when I was two. but I think the place that we are in our history at the moment is one where there's a deep need for the dominance of the ANC to be challenged. We've seen what the unbridled abuse of political power has done to our young democracy over the last few years. And I think it's urgent that all of us do what we can to confront and challenge what the ANC has unfortunately become through corruption, through police brutality, and through the way that our economy is declining. So I was pleasantly surprised by the extent of the losses that the ANC suffered, but I've been rather disheartened by the fact that the message hasn't seemed to get through. If anything, things seem to be getting worse. And I think this period that we're going into up to the ANC's elective conference in 2017 is going to be a test for our country and a test that I hope citizens will stand up and rise to.
Now, another thing that has also been a test for South Africa over the past year has been the discourse around race and racism. I mean, just this week, there was a conference, on race in South Africa. How have you been, how are you negotiating this whole idea of race and racism and oppression in South Africa?
Look, I think race is still the fundamental fault line on which our society divides. And the racialized inequality that we experience in our economy and in the access to opportunities in South Africa is the fundamental challenge which I think our generation and probably generations to come will have to resolve. Now, I think a number of people have started suggesting that somehow race is no longer important because people's ideas are changing and attitudes are slowly shifting. But what I think that forgets is that you can have racism without racists. And part of the problem in South Africa is that the structure of our society is built to facilitate racial inequality. So even if people's attitudes are changing, that doesn't mean that the structure of our society is changing. It just means that people have nice attitudes in an ugly structure. And so I think the real challenge, when you look at a city like Cape Town or when you look at a city like Johannesburg, the real challenge now is not so much worrying about the private outbursts of individuals, which are, of course, lamentable. But the real challenge now is rechanging the structure of our economy, making big policy decisions which change the way that South Africa was designed, whether you're talking about the question of land, whether you're talking about free education, whether you're talking about the way that the state participates in the economy. I think we need to start making serious decisions which actually make our society more unequal. Less unequal.
Yeah. Now, are these some of the themes in your book which you're developing at the moment, Democracy and Delusion?
That's right. Yeah, the book basically looks at 10 myths in South African politics. So each chapter establishes a well-held myth, and then the chapter goes about trying to deconstruct that myth and show why we need to think differently about a certain issue. And then it also offers solutions that haven't really been put forward, in my view, in the public debate to some of the most intractable issues that currently confront South African society. So, for example, one of the chapters is on this question of free education, where I suggest that it's completely plausible and feasible, and then I paint a model that could work for providing free education over a period of 5 years. So there are various different chapters, and I hope that it'll get the public debate moving in a fresh and new direction and hopefully provoke young people to start thinking with and engaging with new ideas.
Wow, that sounds really fascinating. You, at the moment, you're currently busy with a doctorate on the creation of an African nuclear-free zone. Give us some insight on that.
Yeah, one thing that a lot of people don't know about South Africa is that we're the only country to peacefully and voluntarily give up nuclear weapons. And this happened at the time of our transition to the constitutional era. A lot of it happened in secret, but documents are starting to come out which shed more light on this issue. And after South Africa took this decision, Africa itself became a nuclear weapon-free zone. And there are actually a lot of nuclear weapon-free zones across the world. They cover about half the world. So I'm looking into why countries, especially in the global south, outside of the West and Europe, why and how they've come to create nuclear weapon-free zones.
All right. Now, on a lighter note, you are somewhat of a wordsmith, and you were part of a hip-hop group a few years ago. Quite surprising that AKA was part of that group. I had no idea until yesterday that you were...
Oh, gosh, the secret is out.
Yes. Are you still rhyming at the moment? You said you have a hip-hop album coming out with your book. Is that correct?
Definitely. Definitely. It never leaves you. And, you know, I'm always interested to hear, and I know there are some conservative views on art and Islam, and this is something that I've really thought about a lot, because what strikes me is actually how beautifully artistic Islam is as a religion. And when you look at the Quran itself and the way that it uses rhyme and the way that it uses rhythm in order to convey a message, I think you could look at it in a way as the use of poetry to convey an important religious message. Mm. And so I think that tradition is a long tradition, and it's one that we need to continue. Now, the problem with hip hop in its commercial form is that it's often misogynistic, it's materialistic, and it's superficial. Mm. But the use of art to convey powerful political, even spiritual messages is a tradition which I think is in conformity with the values of Islam, and one that I think we can use. So I hope to use hip hop, but to get people thinking and to use beauty as a medium via which you can come to truth or justice.
Mm-hmm. Cesar, we have to sort of end the interview now, but I mean, where do you see yourself in the next 10 years or so? I'd like to think active politics. I'm sure a lot of people tell you that. Where do you see yourself in the next few years?
Yeah, I'm not sure. What I do want to do is make an impact on people's minds and on South Africa itself. Exactly how that happens, I'm not sure, but I'll continue to write and continue to be active and hopefully make the right decisions and get into the right spaces to do that.
Well, you've already got a fan in Auntie Abida on our technical team.
Alhamdulillah.
She says, I don't know him, but already I love him. So there's your number one fan at the moment.
Always work for her if worst comes to worst then.
Cesar, I want to thank you so much for your time. It's been really fascinating to have you on air. You bring such a fresh perspective to South Africa's youth and to our political discourse and political climate at the moment. And so good to have you on air, and hope to touch base with you soon.
Jazakallah khair, and assalamu alaikum to all your listeners.
Wa alaikum salam. Well, that's the voice there of Cesar Mpofu Welsh. He is our face-to-face guest this afternoon. Well, not face-to-face, but via Skype, and a very interesting personality indeed.
Drive Time 91.3.